and slid out of the dress, now fully naked.
Risk me if you want. There's no weapons on this insurgent.
Okay. But only my left hand, he said. Leave the other free. You may be beautiful, but you're still an American.
She responded by stepping forward, kneeling before him, and placing a kiss on his navel. Seeing him nod in pleasure, she continued to tie his left wrist to the seat post. She kissed him again and then abruptly stopped. A look of pity came over her face, followed by her gleaming smile washed in the red light. She reached back into the bag where she'd found the Nanopore tape and pulled out a folding knife with a 5-inch blade. His right hand started to reach out fast, but before he could grab her wrist, she placed the knife in his open palm, the blade still locked shut.
See? Nothing to fear, she said.
She kissed him, starting with his ears, then his chin, and then his neck, drawing out her progress until she stopped at his belt buckle. She reached up and held his free hand, still holding the closed knife. The metallic snap of the blade flashing open was easily heard above the rhythmic piano.
What are you doing? He said.
The knife was open in his right hand, and her fingers wrapped around his, closing his fingers around the handle. Their two clasped hands together, she raised the knife to right in front of her eyes, admiring the sharp edge from up close, its black anodized blade reflecting none of the red light. Then, she drove their clasped hands down, directing the blade's tip toward her chest. She stopped the blade's descent when there was just the faintest pressure on the skin right above her heart. A light prick drew a single drop of blood. It happened so quick he was too surprised to scream, and he sucked in air that should have come out in a howl, but could not. She closed her eyes and breathed deep, seeming to savor the moment.
See, it's okay, she purred. You can trust me.
I don't think so, he said.
Don't be scared. You'll always have the knife to do whatever you want. I just need my hands free now for something else. A little more fun. See? I'll even make sure you don't lose your long knife in all the excitement.
He nodded, and she began to wrap the tape around the hand that held the knife, the blade emerging out along the pinky finger. Then, she took that hand and pointed the knife at her neck, poised just above her jugular vein.
See? Just like your army, you'll be in total control, she whispered.
The blade in his hand then followed her down the same path she'd taken before, always an inch from her neck, until she stopped at his belt buckle. She looked up at him and smiled. With a movement so fast it was hard to see, her hands brought the knife in toward him, and the blade slashed through the leather of his belt. His pants fell to the APC's floor.
You're going to have to explain this one to your commanding officer, she said.
He laughed. Let's stop the games. Come here.
She slid forward and up again onto his naked body. Leaning with all her weight, she pressed her body onto his arm with the blade now wrapped behind her, pulling her in close. Her hands caressed his face, and he started to say something.
Shh, now the fun really starts, she said.
In an instant, Carrie slapped a strip of the Nanopore tape over his mouth and nose. Instinct took over, and he didn't even try to cut her as she slithered quickly down to the floor, and then just out of reach. Instead, he began frantically trying to cut the tape, binding his hand to the chair. The tape held. He grunted, sucking the tape over his mouth as he tried to breathe. And he looked at her, his eyes angry and then almost begging. Carrie tilted her head slightly and studied him, watching silently as he awkwardly turned the taped hand with the blade back at himself, the angle just off, almost like a toddler trying to feed himself, but holding the utensil the wrong way. He poked the blade at first, tentatively trying to create a hole in the bright yellow tape that covered his mouth. But when he couldn't cut the tape, and instead just pushed it inward against the bubble of air trapped beneath, he quickly grew more desperate. He looked at her and gave a piteous whimper as he saw her expressionless study of him. He stabbed harder, and the sharp blade finally sliced through the tape and into his lower lip and tongue. He grunted with pain, unable to fully scream. A spray of blood marked with the yellow leaching color shot outward from the slit in the tape. He tried to suck in air through the half-inch-long slit, but the blood welled inside his mouth, choking him. And another burst of yellow bubbles and red blood spouted from the gash in the tape. He tried to use the blade to widen the opening in the tape over his mouth, gasping through the thin slit. In his frenzy, he didn't even notice the weight of Carrie's hand, now back again on the knife. USS Zumwalt, railgun turret. 200 years ago, a wind like this would have played on a sailing ship's rigging with a wonderful harmony, thought Mike. On the Zumwalt, the 25-knot wind merely sounded like someone had turned up the air conditioning. Just another reason to hate this ship. He snatched another glance at Vern, worming her way inside the railgun turret to double-check the wiring harness that kept shaking loose. She hadn't spoken once during the past hour. Somewhere above them, Secretary of Defense Claiborne was glad-handing the crew, speaking in the easy, confident drawl that to Mike always sounded like she had just finished a modest glass of neat bourbon. The tension Vern carried in her shoulders made her look like she was bracing for a crash. Mike shook his head and eased his way into the turret. Wordlessly, he opened the turret hatch and let the rush of salt air fill the small area. For a moment, the space smelled of somewhere far away in his imagination he rarely visited, the scent of a woman and the sea. Then the acrid smell of hot plastic and ozone returned.
3 minutes, Dr. Lee. You best wrap things up.
Ship Mission Center, USS Zumwalt, eBay Park, San Francisco. The bridge had been the command center of ships going back to the time of Noah. But like so much else in the Zumwalt's class, the Navy designers had decided to make something new, different, and big. The Ship Mission Center stood 2 stories high, the bottom level filled with 4 rows of sailors seated at computer workstations, at a second level with a balcony for the officers to watch down, almost like an interior bridge of the ship. On the walls were massive liquid crystal screens that displayed the ship's location and system status and, at the moment, the 3rd inning of the Giants game. It was that particular screen that held Secretary Claiborne's attention, a pitcher's cap cam focusing in on the squinting eyes behind the catcher's faceplate. The pitcher then pivoted and threw out the runner on first, ending the inning.
All right, let's light it up, she said.
The Secretary of Defense, who'd been an aerospace executive before she was brought into the administration, casually held a cigar in her right hand. It was part of her shtick. That she was more of an old boy than anyone in the old boy's network she'd knocked down on her way to the top of the business. Simmons noticed the cigar was the real thing, not the e-cigar his former mentor smoked indoors. Admiral Murray seemed unfazed by the purple smoke starting to cloud up the room, but this was the first time anybody had smoked inside the Z during his command. He had no idea where she would put it out. There was no ashtray aboard the ship. The test was designed to see how quickly the Zumwalt could deliver a peak power load and how long it could sustain it. This had been a problem during the refurbishment, because they couldn't utilize such power over an extended time without the directorate noticing the surge, which would potentially give away the ship's new capabilities. Simmons nodded at Cortez, who began barking out orders to shift power from the ship systems to the cables linking to shore.
You know, Captain Simmons, said Secretary Claiborne, President Conley is watching back tonight in the Situation Room. Not just for you, of course, he's a big Nationals fan. He had their closer, T.D. Singh, over at the White House a month ago.
One of her military aides, an Army major who scowled at Simmons from behind a pair of thick black assaulter viz glasses, appeared at her side with an empty coffee cup. Claiborne dropped an inch of ash into it.
Thank you, Secretary Claiborne. We're the lucky ones tonight, getting paid to watch the game, said Simmons, smiling at her through the smoke.
Something like that, Captain, said Secretary Claiborne. Take this.
She handed him a San Francisco Giants jersey signed by the team. She shot a look over at her aide and motioned for a pen. He was there in an instant, hovering over her as she took back the jersey, added her own signature to it, and then returned it to Simmons. Wear it in good health, she said. Simmons thanked her with a bemused smile, handed the shirt over to Cortez when she turned away, and then turned to watch the screens showing the ship's power production. On deck, the crew stood near the cables that snaked off the ship and ran under the bay's waters to the pier near the park.
At 99% power capacity, said Cortez. Athena is online. It's green for go.
After the failures they'd had with the Odyssey software, the decision had been made to keep using the old Athena management system. It would have to be isolated, not networked with any other ships for security reasons, but at least they knew it worked.
Execute the transfer, Simmons ordered.
The lights flickered out on the bridge, causing Admiral Murray to wince. On shore, a microsecond later, the stadium lights flickered, and then returned to normal. The ship's systems now feeding their demand, as well as the surrounding neighborhoods. The Z's crew could hear cheering from the park. They knew it wasn't for them. The 44,000 people inside were celebrating a leaping catch that had robbed the Nationals of a home run. But the crew felt like it was for them all the same. A tense silence took over the room. Claiborne mostly tracked the game. The Giants were now at bat and ready to add to their 5-3 lead. Simmons and his officers monitored the screens playing beneath them on the lower deck. Windows onto the ship's system status. None of the crew frantically chasing software glitches or figuring out ways to dump heat buildup were visible. Yet their grueling work was revealed by the soothing reds, blues, and greens of the monitors. The Z was feeding the shifting demands of the park, but at a cost. Self-defense systems went on and offline, secondary systems collapsed, and Athena itself started to act up. Cortez caught Simmons' attention and tapped his own ear. Mike's voice boomed into his headset.
Captain, we can't keep this going more than a minute more, said Mike. We've got thermal management problems with the battery. Fans are running full speed, but they're just heating it up more.
Anything Dr. Lee can do with the software, any tweaks? Said Simmons.
Nothing yet, said Mike. Let me talk to her, said Simmons. She's fighting with one of the machines right now, said Mike. Don't think she can stop. Stand by, said Simmons into his headset.
He put his trigger finger over the microphone near his mouth and, using his command voice, addressed the room.
Nice work, everybody. Nobody has ruined the president's game so far. We've got one more play to make. Admiral Murray and I spoke beforehand, and it's time we threw a curveball.
They wouldn't get more tests like this, so it was important to understand the ship's limits.
XO, take Athena offline, said Simmons. Then bring power output up to 110%.
Mike started to shout, but Simmons just dropped the channel, and the profanity-laced protest disappeared from his ear. A faint smell of burning plastic began to seep into the room, competing with Secretary Claiborne's fragrant cigar.
Max the fans, said Cortez.
His father's voice boomed again in Simmons' ear. He winced out of instinct, an all too familiar feeling.
Captain, we're losing it. Ambient temp in the control room is at 115 degrees. Two of the boxes are cooked. You could put a burger on them. Dr. Lee here says that, said Mike.
I understand, Chief. Task a team to replace them, Simmons said, trying to keep his side of the conversation calm in front of the SecDef.
I'd do it if I had anyone to send. This goddamn ship doesn't have enough crew on it.
Understood, Chief. Keep the power coming, said Simmons again for the crowd.
A flicker on the monitor that was showing the game caught his attention. The stadium lights had gone out for a second and then returned.
Give me Dr. Lee, Simmons ordered. Now.
Yes, Captain, said Vern in his earpiece.
He could hear her inhale and exhale loudly, as if she were coming off a run.
We need to tail off the power now. We weren't expecting to go above the test thresholds. Otherwise, I'm not sure what we can do to keep the ship from burning itself out.
The game's lights flickered again.
Dr. Lee, you have one chance to understand me, said Simmons, his voice rising in volume now, a bit of anger for the audience in the bridge. I don't care about the equipment. The Z is the means, not the end. Now get me results or get off my ship.
He looked over at Admiral Murray. Her face was a mask, leaving him uncertain if he'd just blown it in front of her. Secretary Claiborne looked impressed by his performance. That is, until her aide handed her a phone and whispered, "President Conley."
Moyack, North Carolina.
"Not our usual sort of acquisition, is it?"
Sir Eric Cavendish wore a baggy white dress shirt over a brand new pair of form-fitting technical pants. He looked out the window of the Cadillac Cascade SUV and took in the sprawling camp. As they drove, he felt the vibration of an explosion in the distance resonate through the vehicle's polished aluminum body.
"Well, sir, there's nothing about this location that's usual," said Ali Hernandez, a retired Command Master Chief from DEVGRU, the U.S. Navy's Naval Special Warfare Development Group, more famously known by its original name, SEAL Team 6.
"Not for a long time."
As the lead of Cavendish's personal security team, Hernandez spent a lot of time answering questions. The sir didn't see the world the same way others did, which was why he was so damn rich, but his curiosity could be overwhelming. A day with the sir meant more questions than Ali had been asked in his 30 years in special operations. At times, it was like traveling with a toddler.
"Why does everyone still insist on calling it Blackwater?" said Cavendish, starting up again.
Make that a toddler who could buy anything he wanted, be it the company of a supermodel or a company of private military troops.
"Sir, the waters surrounding the site are murky, and that's what the first business here was named. So even with all the changes, it's the name the locals still use," said Hernandez. "But the way I look at it is, while the lawyers get paid to come up with new names, it's like a call sign. The good ones stick."
"I should have a call sign," said Cavendish. "What was yours?"
"Mine, sir, it's Brick," said Hernandez.
"I suspect that has a story behind it that I will need to ask you about later. But first, let's focus on the important thing. What might mine be?" said Cavendish. "I assume I cannot pick it for myself."
"Correct, sir. Let me do some thinking, as it's a serious matter," said Hernandez.
"Very well. I read the due diligence report on this transaction, did you?" said Cavendish.
"Yes, sir, 8 different owners for the facility," said Hernandez. "You would be the 9th.
"That's a lot of lawyers," said Cavendish.
"It is, sir," said Hernandez.
"And how do you rate our new name for it?" said Cavendish.
The SUV bucked as Hernandez drove straight over a speed bump at 40 miles an hour.
"Exquisite entertainment," said Hernandez.
"I told people I bought it to turn it into a viz studio, all in the name of Cloak and Dagger. But what if we renamed it Blackwater?" asked Cavendish. "I mean, is it a good name?"
They drove by a roofless 3-story apartment building with blackened window frames and a half dozen black-clad men rappelling down its face.
"How do you mean, sir?" said Hernandez. "It's a name my community knows well, still pisses a lot of civs off. But it's good by me."
"Very well," said Cavendish. "We have to keep cover, you know. How about Blackwater Entertainment?"
Hernandez laughed and punched the Cascade's accelerator as soon as it was on the compound's airfield. The electric SUV's speed silently rose to 130 miles an hour.
"Perfectly quiet and exceedingly fast," said Cavendish, his eyes closed in thought. "Just like space."
Ali braked the Cascade hard and then turned inside an airplane hangar. The doors shut behind it. It was almost pitch black inside. Only a soft blue glow lit the corners of the hangar.
"Here we are, sir," said Hernandez.
They stepped out and Cavendish ordered into the air, "Lights!" confident that someone somewhere would follow his command. The lights came on, and thousands of beams of bright rays reflected back at them. A mischievous smile lit up Cavendish's face, while Hernandez just stared with a squint.
"Well, what do you think of it?" said Cavendish.
It was a question that Hernandez couldn't even begin to answer. USS Zumwalt, Mare Island Naval Shipyard. He was too damned old, and now he knew it. Mike could feel the fatigue in his chest. For the first few days, it had felt like a bug, and he'd just worked through it, finding that shouting orders had eased the fatigue's grip. But this morning, it had been like waking up bound to the bed. He would never say it aloud, but Mike was sure he had never been this tired before. It was pure old man exhaustion crossed with the profound fatigue that only those in the military and a few other professions know, the type of weariness you feel when your responsibility for other people's lives far exceeds your physical and mental reserves. This was the kind of tired that no amount of stims or coffee would help. He swayed and steadied himself near the entrance to the bridge.
"Chief, you okay?"
said Horatio Cortez, the XO.
"You look like shit. You take the younger generation out bar hopping last night? Teach them how you did it back in the day?"
"Wishful thinking, sir," said Mike. "They couldn't even begin to keep up with us."
Cortez wasn't fooled by Mike's banter. He could see the fatigue in the old chief's Tabasco red eyes, and he quickly excused himself and went back to the bridge. Mike knew he could find one of the better nooks to sleep in aboard the ship, down near the magazine for the railgun. A sailor taking a power nap in a cool, dark spot was an honored Navy tradition. But it could also be a warning that something was not right with that sailor. As Mike lay back against the cool bulkhead, he wondered which it was in his case. Wondered if he had what it took anymore. Then he drifted off. It was the smell that woke him. Fresh soap and violets. Dr. Lee. He opened his eyes and saw her curled up on the other side of the bulkhead. Their legs crossed each other's in the middle. Her feet looked so tiny compared to his. Jesus, if anybody saw this, Mike thought. He expected to wake up with the ship under attack more than he expected to wake up and see her next to him. How she'd found him, he didn't know. She stirred and arched her back like a cat, then sat up. She spoke as if she knew what he'd been thinking.
"I finally had time to grab a shower, and then I saw you head down here to your hiding spot," she smiled. "And I thought, he knows what he's doing. He's just taking care of the equipment, as he so kindly calls the crew. So I decided to follow the old man's lead."
"Who are you calling an old man? You look just as tired as me, Dr. Lee."
"You got me there. I've got nothing left," she said, rubbing her eyes. "And it's Vern. If we're going to sleep together, you can start using my first name."
Mike felt the Zumwalt lurch and lifted his head slightly, like a hunting dog. They must be drilling the engine restart again, he thought.
"Listen, I'm sorry about the captain last night. He knows this ship is no damned good," he said.
"It's okay," Vern responded. "He was right, and he had the right to let go like that. Captain's prerogative that they keep talking about."
"No, he doesn't have the right to take his anger out on someone else. It took me too long to learn that lesson, so I couldn't pass it on to him," said Mike.
He avoided her eyes and stared at the bulkhead.
"You know, nobody ever told me what I'm supposed to do if things start burning again," she said, consciously changing the subject to one that might put him back in his comfort zone.
"The damage control drills? You don't remember any of that?" he asked.
"If the ship's fate hangs on my ability to play firefighter," she said, "then we're all doomed."
Mike noticed that although she'd sat up, she'd done it in a way that kept her legs intertwined with his.
"You'll figure it out. Just follow an old man's lead, as you say."
She smiled again.
"Well, we'd better get back to work," he said. "I'm pretty sure the Z will be leaving port soon, most likely for Australia."
"What makes you say that?" she asked.
"I'm guessing from what Brooks, that tech with the stupid mohawk, told me about some of the software mods to Athena. Weapons loadout is full, which we wouldn't be doing for another test."
"Australia's dangerous?" said Vern.
"It's the Navy, what isn't?" said Mike. "But it means we'll be escorting reinforcement ships. You're less likely to be shot at when you're looking for the easiest way to get to friendly territory than when you're out looking for trouble. There are no guarantees, though."
The Zumwalt shuddered again, and Mike sat up. Then he reached out his hand to help Vern to her feet. She noticed the rough feel of the skin.
"Don't worry," he said. "I'll be at your side when it counts."
USS Zumwalt, Mare Island Naval Shipyard.
"Status report," said Captain Jamie Simmons into the intercom. "What's going on up there?"
The system was dead. There was not even static in reply. From his stateroom, He peered out into the dark beyond the hatch. Nothing. No klaxon. No shouting. It was almost pitch-black dark. The only light, the yellow emergency reflective tape along the corridor floor. Shaking the sleep from his head, he started to make his way along the passageway toward the bridge. He knew the route well enough. A sharp jab at his forehead made him curse in pain. He ducked too late, and dropped to one knee until the specks of pain-driven light faded. He reached for the bulkhead to carefully stand back up and felt something warm. Soft. Hair.
"Who's there?"
he asked.
"Seaman Oster Couch, sir,"
said a timid voice. The fear evident in the hesitant pronunciation of the word sir made Simmons's head ache anew. He felt his cheeks get hot and his stomach knot in rage.
"This is Captain Simmons. What are you doing here?"
he said, fighting to hold back his anger.
"I was coming back from the head and I heard a big bang, and then the lights went out," said Couch. "So I waited, but they didn't come back on."
"You belong at your station, Seaman Couch. Up!"
"I don't know where it is, sir," said Couch. "In the dark, sir."
"Find it if you have to crawl on your hands and knees," said Jamie. "I'm heading to the bridge, and if I find you here again in the dark, you'll learn there are far scarier places the Navy can send you."
"On my way, sir," said Couch.
Simmons had almost gotten to the bridge when the Zumwalt shuddered and all the lights came back on.
"Cortez, what is going on with this ship?" said Simmons.
"Power surge, sir," said Cortez. "It's railgun related, and we're trying to figure out why it took the entire ship offline."
"Everything? Athena too?"
said Simmons. "Yes, sir, everything," said Cortez. "But there's no fires, and Dr. Lee is down working on it now. We'll be okay."
"XO, when you have the bridge, this ship is yours," said Simmons.
The anger at Seaman Couch welled over, and he spat his words out at Cortez.
"Treat it that way. There is nothing okay about this. You know what's going to happen when we get a surge like this out there?"
He pointed west toward the ocean.
"Do you? We're nothing more than a target for the Directorate. First, we blow the last part of the test with the Admiral and SecDef on board, and now we can't even get the goddamn gun turned on without it killing us? What kind of a ship do we have here? This is on you, Cortez. Get Dr. Lee and fix it."
The captain spun around to see his father entering the bridge. The old chief had that look of only slightly veiled disappointment he knew too well. He brushed past his father without acknowledging him.
"I'm going to be in my stateroom," said Jamie.
He started to leave, then stopped.
"Belay that. I'm going down to speak to Dr. Lee about her fix. Cortez, you have the bridge."
He heard footsteps behind him as he stormed down the ladder wells.
"Captain, I'll accompany you," said Mike.
Jamie kept walking, mindful of any new overhanging fixtures and cabling that might strike his already aching head. He put two fingers to the spot he'd hit, certain it was bleeding. It was. What a sight that must have been on the bridge.
"A word, if I may, Captain," said Mike.
"As we walk," said Jamie.
"Sir, you need to get some rest," said Mike. "I'll say it because nobody else will."
"How can I? I'd say this port time is making us dull. But we're so far from sharp that it's not even worth bringing up," said Jamie.
"Still have to rest, Captain," said Mike. "The job demands it, even if you don't think so."
"This job," said Jamie, stopping abruptly and standing close to his father. "You don't understand this job. I'm the senior officer, and it's my ship. You can't understand that."
"I can't," said Mike.
His face began to redden, and that all-too-familiar angry blood vessel that snaked down his forehead began to pulse.
"I can't? No. I'm an officer," said Jamie, no longer afraid of that pulsing. "I have actual responsibility."
Mike leaned forward with the intent look that signaled to anyone, even an officer, that he or she was a single step away from receiving a heavy blow from one of his massive hands.
"The hell with you, Jamie," said Mike. "I don't care if you embarrass yourself in front of me, but you ought to think twice before you embarrass yourself in front of the crew again."
Mike turned around and stomped off, each angry footfall muffled by the non-skid rubber in the passageway. Nautilus Restaurant, Palo Alto, California.
Daniel DeBoye couldn't help but stare. Before the war, this had been a regular haunt of his investors. The types who had net worths so big they'd stopped counting their money. He'd come here tonight with a new sense of awe, mostly at how wrong the place felt on so many levels. He watched a tuna as long as his motorcycle swam steadily around the restaurant's tank in the ceiling. The readout on his glasses showed how many other diners had bid on it. 7. He decided he would be the 8th and end the auction. The other bidders would likely interpret it as a showing of the depth of his wallet, but it was more an indication of the depth of his annoyance that they were all still carrying on this way in the midst of a war. When he looked down, there she was.
"When you asked to meet me for dinner," said Aboye, "this was certainly not the place I expected you would choose."
"I like the fresh fish," said Corey Silkins with mock innocence. "It's at least something that isn't rotting around here." Aboye took in the woman across from him. She was always smiling, but ironically. Back at Stanford, they'd been first-year hallmates. It had taken him a while to get used to her sarcasm, but he quickly came to appreciate the fact that she didn't put him on a pedestal like the other students did once they knew his backstory. Instead, she treated him like she treated everyone else, as a target. They'd even become friends of a sort after Corey realized his gentle nature truly was genuine, and he realized that her acidity meant that she couldn't help but tug and trick. She soon found bigger and better targets than the gangly but confident DeBoye. Besides writing code, Corey's main passion on campus had been pranking assholes. Faculty or student, it didn't matter. She'd outed the members of a secret fraternity after they tried to cover up a date rape that occurred at their initiation ceremony. And she'd posed as a former U.S. president, using his hacked email account to carry on a 3-month-long online conversation with the old provost. Of course, Corey had grown up and sold out like the rest of them, as she joked at the sale of her software encryption company, a deal brokered by Aboye. When he asked what she was going to do next, she told him that she was off on a quest for a glass of the most remarkable red wine in the world. He thought it was another joke, but she'd spent the past year chronicling it all in real time for her online followers. Before this, he hadn't heard from her since the post about a Malbec in Argentina.
"So, what brings you back?" asked Aboye now.
"I heard you went to Washington," Corey said. "I thought they might have drafted you, so I had to come back and rescue you."
"They wanted nothing to do with me," he said. "That, I must say, hurt deeply."
"Morons. You know, I've gotten a few quiet offers to leave. Finland, Brazil, Argentina," she said. "I wish France, but I think I am still on some blacklist there."
He'd heard the same from several of his other friends. From a business perspective, it made sense to him. America's wealthy were distressed assets themselves right now. The right luminaries, along with their intellectual capital and their bank accounts, could be had cheap.
"Are you considering it?" he asked.
"No, I prefer the life of an itinerant bacchanal," she said.
"That's for the best. You are indeed a national treasure," he said.
"Okay, what is really up, Corey? Why did you ask me here?" A waiter wordlessly brought them their wine. Neither needed to be told what it was, because the Firestone Petite Syrah's label was already displayed on their viz glasses.
She pulled her wine glass over and held the stem between her long fingers, which were adorned with a dozen slim-brushed platinum and diamond rings. The rings gleamed with flecks of light from the fish tank's blue glow overhead, and the red wine before them.
"Daniel, do you know why I love wine? It's not the taste, it's the history. And not just the history of the grape or the terroir that defines it. I mean the history of wine itself. Wine was the very first drink of equality," said Silkins. "The ancient Greeks would pour it into a bowl in the middle of a room, and guests would gather around. They'd share it, the same bowl, and just talk, philosophy, rights, democracy, hell, maybe even sports. Anyone and everyone could take part in the conversation, from Socrates to his youngest student." She laughed to herself. "Of course, it was all men, and then the Romans ruined it by conquering Greece and turning wine into a prestige item so assholes like me could run around chasing a perfect glass of it." He looked at her and took a sip. Clearly, Corey was building up to something. She swirled her glass. "That sense of equality is what made the internet so great,"
anyone and everyone could gather and participate, and that, too, is at risk of being ruined by assholes.
And? He said. She looked down at her glass and then directly up at Aboye.
I know what you're up to.
Aboye distractedly glanced up at one of the divers gently herding a fish into a net.
What could I possibly be up to? He asked. Daniel, you're not a good liar, so let's not screw around, she said. I know what you and your buddies are doing in Hangar One, and I know that it's not going well, what with all the water damage to your library.
Aboye pinched the bridge of his nose, pausing as if to think, but mostly to cover his concern. If she knew, who else did? And was Corey going to cause problems just because she was pissed off that he hadn't asked her to join?
Let's go, said Aboye in a whisper.
Aboye and Silkins walked out of the restaurant, Silkins paying with her iTab bracelet at the table as she got up. They stood outside in front of the motorbike stand.
Okay, Corey, what is it you want? And I still don't get why you asked me here.
You needed a visual reminder. Restaurants like this, they're for a certain kind of person. The kind you've been hanging out with. Nobody's angry. How far is San Francisco? The city's transforming itself into a navy town again. Ugly, rusting gray ships being fixed all over the place. Sailors getting drunk and fighting. Not out of malice, but to release something. Anger at not being out there, or maybe just some newfound hate. Down here, it's business as usual. Where can I get my fresh fish or my favorite pizza next?
She climbed aboard his yellow electric BMW C1, as usual taking things without asking.
You have great people in Hangar One, but they know only how to build. You also need people who know how to tear down, she said. You need assholes like me. Get on and I'll show you.
Aboye folded his body uncomfortably behind her, under the C1's canopy, and they glided off silently through downtown Palo Alto. Light from restaurants and storefronts that were being used as sidewalk cafes after hours spilled out onto the road before them. Since the war, everyone wanted to spend more time outside, it seemed to Aboye. It made Palo Alto more festive than he had ever seen it, as if all of the town's residents were Stanford seniors, and this was commencement week. They soon were sitting on Silken's thickly carpeted living room floor. She booted up her connection into the virtual world. Daniel watched as she put on a bright pink helmet with a matte black visor. She thought it made her look like a cross between a teenage skateboarder and a fighter pilot. She wouldn't let him join her inside the 3D environment.
Too much for you to handle, plus they scatter when any outsider comes within a mile. That's how we've kept it going, she said.
Aboye watched Silkins navigate on a screen above her fireplace. He saw Silkins' avatar, a bizarre yellow and blue cartoon fish that looked like Salvador Dali had designed it, swimming alongside what looked to be an abstract, submerged rendition of Las Ramblas in Barcelona. She darted and drifted among other resplendent but unnerving avatars, everything from Hello Kitties to nude supermodel bodies with robot heads. Then trailing bubbles, each apparently an encrypted key that verified who she was. She stopped at the open door of a hat store. She flicked open her visor and looked at Daniel, jumping from the online world back to the real world.
Let me make this clear. This is not about patriotism, she said. Our reasons are not yours. You know that, right? We're about the net itself. Songs about flags, sending kids to die, mom and apple pie, all those lies. We don't buy any of that crap the system sells. But in this case, our interests align. We'd like to help you.
What do you mean, we? He said.
You don't need to know that. My friends prefer to remain anonymous.
USS Zumwalt, Mare Island Naval Shipyard. Mike moved as fast as a man his age could move through a warship's cramped passageways and ladder wells. The shouting got louder, and he forced himself to move even faster. The clanging of metal on metal had him nearly running.
She's one of them, said Petty Officer Parker. Just look at her.
Mike took in the scene in less than a second. Parker, Wrench, Vern. He swung a left-handed punch with his entire body weight behind it and hit Parker square in the stomach. A following jab from his right hand landed just above Parker's heart, knocking the sailor back into the bulkhead, just like he'd taught Jamie to do in the garage so many years ago. Vern was sprawled on her back on the deck. He reached down to give her a hand, just as she looked behind him and screamed. Mike ducked at the last moment, and the blow from the wrench glanced off his shoulder. He grunted with anger, more at himself than Parker. It had been over 20 years since he'd last gotten into a fight, but some things he should not have forgotten. As he had been told by a senior chief when he was starting out in the Navy, there were 2 rules to remember in a bar fight. Punch second, and leave first. But only after you're 100% sure the other guy is completely out of the fight. The arc of Parker's swing had left him off balance in the tight corridor, so Mike bent lower to duck the backswing. He turned, feinted with his right, then moved in close, and punched with his left, a short stiff uppercut, a liver shot. He felt his knuckles crack as they smashed into Parker's side at the 9th and 10th ribs. He taught Jamie that move, told him to use it only when the fight moved from boxing to brawling. A liver shot was shocking and debilitating, causing the other guy to lose his breath and sometimes even consciousness. It was also excruciatingly painful. Parker's desperate suck of air energized Mike. He hit him again hard with a close-in combination, and then another. Hear the thuds that echoed inside the room. The adrenaline made his own ears ring, but he could feel the impact of the strikes resonating through Parker's flesh. He caught his breath, and as Parker crumpled, he struck with one more combination. Though he knew Parker was in too much pain to hear anything, Mike shouted at him, "You coward! How's it feel?" This was a show for the others who had gathered and were now standing back in a mix of awe and fear of the old man. And then he stopped hitting him. Parker, like Vern, was equipment. He was part of the ship, and Mike was responsible for him, too. Through it all, none of Mike's blows had touched Parker's face. Stand him up at attention before the captain, and no one would ever know he'd just gotten his ass kicked by a man old enough to be his father. That was the way of his Navy. He turned to the thick crowd of sailors.
"Who else agrees with him? Maybe you want to intern all the Chinese in San Francisco, ship him out to Angel Island like in the last World War," shouted Mike.
Parker, trying to get up, was now on his hands and knees, wheezing.
"Dr. Lee is one of us," said Mike. "If we win, it'll be because of her. If we die, it's because of asshats like you."
He reached down and yanked Parker up by his arm. The man cast his gaze down to avoid making eye contact.
"Look at me. And this goes for the rest of you, too. You don't like it? Then you have 5 minutes to get off my ship. If you stay, and this happens again, I won't just play patty cake like today. Test me. See if I am not 1,000% serious. Dismissed!"
Parker shuffled out of sight along with the rest of the crowd.
"Vern, everything okay?" asked Mike, helping her up.
"We lost time just now, and we can't afford to," said Vern. She glared at him, angry at Mike for rescuing her as if she were some lost little girl, and livid at herself for feeling so damned vulnerable.
"I'm not asking about the ship, I'm asking about you," said Mike.
She didn't respond, but she leaned into him. He stood there, unsure of what he should do. She started shaking, and he wrapped his tattooed arms around her. He couldn't see her face, pressed into his chest, so he looked down at his left hand, pretty sure the ring finger was broken. He felt good, though. Moyock, North Carolina.
"Please don't tap the glass, sir," said Hernandez. "It makes the animals crazy."
Cavendish pressed his face right up to a porthole. The shipping container, which was connected to 2 more in a U-shaped form, had been made watertight and then filled with water. Each container was about the size of a large apartment, or one of the bedrooms in Cavendish's South Kensington, London, block-long flat.
"I don't see anything. Are they in there?" said Cavendish.
He tapped on the plexiglass porthole again.
"Yes, sir," Hernandez says. "Why don't you try the viz glasses they gave us?"
Cavendish put on the matte black, special-made viz glasses that had been hanging around his neck. His fingers rubbed the firm's old bear paw logo on the side.
What a simple proposition this all was. How did the original owner so truly screw the business up? Said Cavendish. I have my theories, but...
He instinctively ducked as soon as the glasses clicked on. A long knife lunged for him, as he virtually counterpunched using some kind of ancient-looking brass trench knife. He settled into the fight, watching through the viz, becoming a part of the sparring from the perspective of a mass cam worn by one of the commandos. The lighting inside the container varied. Every few seconds, the lights brightened and then faded to almost pitch black again. The men seemed to be wearing gray and black tiger-striped bodysuits that were accessorized with a variety of edged weapons. Swiss micro-rebreather units, the kind used by cave divers, were affixed to their upper backs. When the lights flashed on inside the tank at one point, Cavendish realized that those were not tiger-striped camouflage patterns on the gray bodysuits. They were slash marks. He felt a tap on his shoulder.
"Sir, this is Aaron Best. He was a DevGru with me. Best is the one who provides the adult supervision for selection and training," said Hernandez. "I'll let him fill you in on where we are."
"Welcome, Sir Eric. It is an honor to have you here. What you're watching is a refinement of our tactics, techniques, and procedures. This is a simulation of a partial power plant failure. That is why the lighting goes in and out. We also simulate total power failure, which plays out the way you would expect. A knife fight in a closet in the dark. This is a 10-minute evolution. It involves a 9-minute air supply, and the man with the fewest slash marks on his suit wins. He gets to get out first. The loser has to wait until the 10-minute mark before he can exit the tank."
"Quite an incentive," said Cavendish.
"In a man-on-man scenario, it's tough but appropriate. Where it gets tricky for the guys is when you put three of them in there," said Best. "The last guy out has it pretty rough."
"What about those outfits they're wearing?" asked Cavendish.
"Standard long-range recon swim kit. Blast-proof, thermal regulation, which we enhanced for the mission. We think it will be effective," he said.
Cavendish's attention wandered, and he stared at a set of 7 connected shipping container halves.
"That's the training box," said Best. "Same idea as what you see here, but it's for them to practice team on team. Same protocol, 10 minutes for the losers. It's a lot harder, actually, not just because of the teaming, but also because we put a bunch of metal junk in there to simulate the interior. Essentially, it's like you're fighting a group of rabid monkeys in an airplane bathroom." An arched eyebrow was Cavendish's only response. Hernandez passed Cavendish one of the weapons. It was a titanium-handled, steel-bladed, brass-knuckled trench knife, about a foot long. The anodized black coating had worn off on the knuckles and blade edges, both of which Cavendish inspected closely with the authority of someone who'd spent a year of his youth cornering the market on Japanese fighting swords.
"More sword than knife," said Cavendish. "Can I keep this?"
Hernandez looked at Best with a nod.
"Yes, sir, technically you already own it," said Best.
"Too kind," said Cavendish.
"We will make the first selection 72 hours before launch," said Best. "The top 6 out of 24. 4 will be in the boarding party, 2 will remain in reserve."
That explained the intensity of the underwater fight he'd just watched, thought Cavendish. "These men really want to go, don't they?" said Cavendish.
"Of course, Sir Eric. The awards you've offered are more than generous, but really, they just want to get back in the game," said Best.
Cavendish returned the viz glasses to Hernandez.
"Do you have all the medical performance investment you need?" said Cavendish.
Best looked at Hernandez, who nodded.
"When we make the selection of our final 6, I would like to authorize further cognitive augmentation, and a couple of other things that the JSOC Meat Department is now using with the 160th Hilo drivers and the Persistent Operations Group," said Best.
"That is, I believe, a permanent change?" said Cavendish.
"It's in their contract," said Best.
"Very well," said Cavendish. "Hernandez will see to it. One last question before we meet the team. Something's been bothering me," said Cavendish.
"I'm sorry to hear that, Sir Eric. What is it?" "We have time before launch to address it," said Best.
"What are we going to do about all the blood?" said Cavendish. "It can't exactly flow out the scuppers. We need to figure out how to clean up the mess afterward."
Fort Mason, San Francisco. Jamie Simmons chewed his pasta quietly and stared at the coffee mug that he'd set on the table. As he chewed, he worked his way through the day's decisions on the Z, especially the regrets.
these should've and could've moments that were all the more important now that they were running out of time. He went over the day from start to finish, but he kept fixating on the fact that he should have stopped at the pierside bench before coming home. He'd let himself rush in to see Lindsay, but that 5-minute decompression was one of the most important moments in his day, a time to pause and master his thoughts, to transition through the purgatory zone between duty and home, between war and family. He knew he was on edge and shouldn't have rushed back, but it was the fact that he was missing them at home that had made him rush. This led him to recall his life before the war, when he'd never thought twice about what he ate or threw away, or whether some should've, could've decision of his would end up leaving his sailors among the many burned carcasses cast into the Pacific. He became angry at himself for not following through on that pre-war longing to be with his family, for his failure to act before their separation could turn permanent. Jamie looked up and saw Lindsay studying him as he ate. She knew something was not right. His tension was clearly feeding hers. "You look tired," said Lindsay. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing," said Jamie. "Let's start over. I'm sorry, it's just been one of those days."
"Seems like you have those every day," she said, a slight edge in her voice.
"I do," said Jamie. "The closer we get to deploying, the harder it is. The crew is exhausted, and they know the ship is not where it needs to be."
"It's getting harder for all of us," said Lindsay. "You need to make time for the kids. They were asking—"
"Asking what?"
"When you're leaving again."
"What did you tell them?"
"You'll have to go soon, but it won't be forever."
"Better not be."
"I need to ask you something. I let it go after Pearl Harbor, but I have to know. I just do. Did you ever tell Riley you were done?"
"Jesus, Lindsay, does it matter? Does it really matter? He died, bled out in front of me as close as we're sitting here. You want to know what he thought of my career?"
"It does matter to me. There's no—"
A banging and a crash from upstairs stopped her. They heard an old man cursing and then Martin laughing. Jamie's eyes flicked over to the sound. Lindsay looked down. "Why are the kids still up? And what's he doing here?" said Jamie.
He put his fork down with a sharp clink and reached for his coffee mug. Staring hard at Lindsay, he took a pull of the cold, bitter coffee dregs that should have ended up at his feet an hour ago. "He's fixing the toilet. It couldn't wait," she said. "He came by the other day and worked with Martin to print the part we needed with a 3D printer he'd cadged from one of his harbor buddies. They had a lot of fun. I know what you told me about him coming here, but I think he just wanted to be with his family before— what could I do?"
"You could actually do what I ask," snarled Jamie.
"I could say the same thing," Lindsay replied coldly. He didn't know whether she was referring to the broken toilet, time with the kids, or his promise to leave the Navy. He didn't care. In any case, he knew he was in the wrong, and he didn't like it.
"I don't have time for this. I need to prep for tomorrow."
He grabbed the weighty folder full of personnel assignment reports and walked out of the room, leaving his plate of shrimp and pasta mostly uneaten, a testament to his disappointment. He went down the hallway quietly, passing the open bathroom door. He'd disappointed enough people tonight and hoped he wouldn't run into his father, since that would only lead to the knockdown argument he'd just avoided by walking out on Lindsay. It was probably the wrong call, going to bed angry, especially with so little time left. Yet another bad decision to regret. He quickly rounded the corner and walked into his office. Door shut, he sat at his desk. He reached to turn on the desk lamp, but then paused in the dark. His eyes slowly adjusted to the room until he was almost able to make out the picture his son had drawn, tacked to the wall next to the window facing west. It was a magnificent green, yellow, and blue warship, taking up 3 pieces of paper taped together lengthwise. Depending on what part of the vessel you looked at, it was either a triple-decker or a double-decker, armed with red turrets from which bird legs jutted out at all angles. Pink hearts covered the hull, and a small flag with a blue star flew from the stern with the words, "Win Daddy" on it. His wife called it the Love Boat, and the sight of it made Jamie's eyes well up with tears. A soft click in the hallway meant the bathroom door was closed. The heavy tread of Mike's boots going down the stairs told Jamie he no longer had to worry about seeing his father tonight. He wiped his eyes, got up from his seat, and looked out the window at the top part of the Golden Gate Bridge. Every time he saw the bridge like this in the fog, his stomach tightened. He knew the next time he passed under it, he would be with his father on what would likely be their last cruise. Moana Surf Rider Hotel, Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. 10 o'clock. That was all he had said when he slid the room card across the rental counter to her. Nothing more, just a wink and a smile before he walked off, his hair still dripping seawater. A gold Rolex dive watch hung loosely on his left wrist, exposing a whisker of paler skin beneath the tan. He hadn't even given his name, assuming she had to know who he was. And he was right. Supposedly, his uncle ran Belcon, the electronics company in Chengdu. One of the maids Carrie occasionally drank coffee with had shared the gossip when he first arrived. A creature of the night, she had added with a shiver. The really rich were like that, Carrie had seen, no matter what country they were from. They always assumed you knew what they wanted and that you needed to be told only when and where to provide it. In this case, he didn't have to tell her where. The hotel key card had said that for him. It was polished to look like platinum, but really it was cheap aluminum. As she waited in line for another security checkpoint to access the staff elevators to the hotel's VIP suites and rooms, she ran her finger across the outline of three palm trees cut out of the middle of the card, indicating it was the key to the Moana Surf Rider's penthouse suite number 3. The Chinese Marine on duty was making everyone go through a portable body scanner, and the staff members waiting to be scanned one more time before they could get on with their jobs were getting annoyed. The most annoyed were the waiters, standing silently in their white pants and fitted black short-sleeved turtleneck shirts, who knew they'd be berated for being late. Waiters. That was the right word for them all. Waiting for the checkpoint line to move, for the war to end, for death. Carrie bided her time, putting the room key in her back pocket next to her ID and filing her nails with an emery board. The floors in the hallway area were scuffed, and only half the lights worked. It was the kind of neglect she had started to see all over the hotel. Knowing the stakes involved with this new clientele, the staff kept the exterior and guest hallways brighter and cleaner than they'd been even before the invasion. But behind the scenes, where the staff worked and lived out their days, the hallways were taking on the worn and tired feel of subway tunnels. Carrie picked a piece of surfboard wax from under the nail of the ring finger of her left hand and subtly flicked it to the ground. After he dropped off the card, she'd stayed busy scraping the boards down, getting the sand-flecked wax off inch by inch.
"Next," said the Chinese Marine.
He did not use a translator device. His English was pretty decent. She flashed her hotel ID at him and returned it to her back pocket, then set the emery board down on the table and stepped through the scanner. The scanner warbled like a tropical bird as she picked up her things.
"What's in the back pocket of your shorts?" he said.
"It's my ID, okay? The lanyard broke." She flashed him the ID again, the room key hidden behind it, holding the two cards up with a stiff arm like she was some kind of special agent. He ran another body scan and found nothing. Two of the waiters behind her stifled chuckles.
"And that? What's it for?"
he said, motioning to the emery board. He picked it up and examined it closely. "It's for my nails," she said, taking it from him and putting it in her pocket.
"You can go," the Marine said, turning to the next person in line.
The elevator doors hissed open, and she stepped inside. She pulled out the emery board and started to file again, this time more intently. The elevator sighed, slowing down as it came to the top floor. As the door opened, Carrie brushed the edge of the metallic key card lightly across the inside of her elbow. It was now sharp enough to draw blood. Moana Surf Rider Hotel, Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone.
"Lieutenant, you're missing the view," said Markov. "It really is a great place to die."
Lieutenant Jian was too busy dry-heaving over the railing to take in the aquamarine panorama of the Pacific that lay before them. The young officer finally looked up and angrily wiped his mouth with the back of his right hand. He scanned the horizon, squinting at the rooftops of the nearby buildings, with his hand resting on the pistol at his hip.
"You're right, Gian. There could be insurgent snipers here also admiring the view," said Markov. "Why don't you go back inside and tell them to turn the hot tub off? Come get me when our friend stops boiling, and we can take a better look at the body. It'll be easier up close." He smiled.
John was stone-faced when he returned a few minutes later. The water in the tub was now calm, no longer bubbling, but still wine-dark red. The dead man lay with his head resting on the teak wood behind him, revealing a crimson gill-like slit across his neck.
"Lieutenant, is he naked?"
"Sir, I cannot see into the water," said Lieutenant Gian. "It's
We need to know if he's wearing his shorts or not," said Markov. "Find out."
Gian looked toward the body in the room and then back at Markov.
"Come on," said Markov. "You don't get to earn your combat zone badge without seeing a little blood and some naked bodies. Roll up your sleeves and get to work."
Markov pretended not to watch as Gian tried to figure out what to do next. Finally, he started toward the tub, rolling up his sleeves.
"Stop," shouted Markov. "It's an expression the Americans use. You are actually going to reach down in there? Maybe you are braver than I thought."
Markov continued to chuckle to himself as he reached into a duffel bag full of equipment and turned on a black light tube about the size of a D-battery flashlight. He found another one and tossed it to Lieutenant Gian.
"Of course he's naked. From what we heard from the guard downstairs, he likely spent half his time in Hawaii naked."
He and the aide entered the room. Markov passed Gian a pair of goggles and put on a pair himself. The ultraviolet light swept the room for DNA traces, skin, blood, and any human fluids.
"Extraordinary," said Markov as white splotches filled his view of the room. "How did he even get up there?"
He realized Lieutenant Gian had gone back to the balcony again and shouted,
"It seems your boy here was a very busy young man indeed. Start tracing him, but be sure you're wearing gloves. And I hope you've had all your shots."
Markov began to take swabs, and the DNA analytics started cross-checking databases for identities. Throughout the hotel suite, tiny faces began to appear in the field of view provided by the sensor goggles. One popped up wherever there was a concentration of DNA from a particular person, and soon there were faces looking back at Markov from all over. A few were from directorate security sweeps. Some others were linked to pre-war Hawaii driver licenses. But the vast majority were mugshots from the Hawaii Police Department files. The colorful, faintly shimmering profile pictures were mostly of young women. He reached out, touched the closest virtual card that hung in the air, and flipped it over to see the file display. An arrest record for prostitution. He flipped another. Prostitution and drug charges. And then another. Prostitution and drunk and disorderly. Markov then swept his hand across the room, virtually grabbed all the pictures and began to sort them, putting those with criminal records in a stack on one side of the room, and those with non-arrest records, a smaller stack hanging in the air on the other side. Lieutenant Gian rejoined him and started pulling down the tabs of those with arrest records.
"I am sure the general will want us to round them all up, and then we can process them on our own terms," said Gian. "Think so? Your boy made his way through half the prostitutes in Hawaii. Arrest them all, and you'll have an uprising on your hands, but not from the locals," said Markov,
tabbing through the stack of those without arrest records, mostly hotel staff.
"These poor maids, they deserved combat pay to come in here."
Markov's index finger stopped and rested on the image of a young woman that hung in the air. A driver's license. He had seen her before. He flipped the picture over. Yes, the look in her eyes was different. But that was her, all right. What had the surf shop girl been doing all the way up here? Alto Cafe, Queen Street and Ward Avenue, Honolulu, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone.
"Traitor," one of them snarled. The glares of the locals waiting out the day in a thick cloud of marijuana smoke inside the old Quonset hut on Queen Street told her she was in enemy territory, even though she was among her own people. Their scowls and squints after they took in her outfit, a sea-blue tank top as tight as a bathing suit and iridescent white form-fitting pants, gave the room a new menace.
"Whore," another said with a cough.
A subdued Colombian reggae band played in the background. It was one of the band Global Peace Movement songs. She had to speak up to be heard by the girl behind the bar when she asked where the bathroom was. "Customers only," said a teenage girl with a crown of thorns tattoo, wreathing her bald head.
"I just have to pee, please," said Carrie. "Then buy a coffee or a smoke," said the girl.
"Just coffee," said Carrie, tossing a 100 RMN note on the counter.
"Bathroom's back there, lock's broken," said the girl with a look of disdain.
Carrie weaved her way through the low tables to the back of the restaurant. She kept her eyes on the floor, not out of embarrassment, but out of fear that someone would trip her if she didn't watch her step. A man in his 50s wearing a dirty white wool cap mottled with ash burns winked at her from behind a pair of taped-up Viz glasses. Then he beckoned her over, curling a plump finger. The simple act of signaling her made his massive weight stress the wooden chair further. He brushed crumbs and ash from his clothing, a formless black t-shirt that went down to his ankles like a dress. She gave him a quick glance that he would replay again and again on his glasses later. "Piss off," she said. "You can't afford it." Playing the act of someone past caring. Or was it an act anymore? Then she moved carefully past him toward the bathroom. She looked at her translucent G-Shock and saw she had 3 hours until the 9 o'clock lockdown. The return of curfew had done more damage to directorate troop morale than the local insurgents had. She leaned in toward the mirror, reapplying lipstick. She was sure the two men following her had been directorate. They'd had flip-flops, loose linen pants, and bright floral t-shirts, but the colors were too bright. The shirts had clearly been bought recently. They didn't have the weathered look that real locals' clothing had. Definitely directorate. And she knew why they were after her. She waited in the bathroom for 15 minutes. Then she fixed her hair and washed her hands. Maybe they weren't following her anymore, which made it time for her to go back out there and face the hate, anger, and poison she saw in the expressions of her fellow Hawaiians every day. Hand on the doorknob, she paused and breathed, preferring the stink of the dirty bathroom to the lazy funk of the coffee shop. The door crashed in before she had a chance to open it. A pair of black-gloved hands threw her against the bathroom wall, knocking a faded photo of Waikiki Beach to the ground, its cheap wooden frame broken to pieces. Then she was hauled to her feet, dragged along the corridor, and thrown forward onto the cafe floor. She looked up just as a knee drove into her back. Coffee dripped from one of the tables onto her head and down her face, and she blinked the stinging liquid from her eyes. The customers were gone. She didn't have to check to know the door was locked. Nobody who'd seen her walk in was going to call for help. Carrie tried to push herself up, straining against the weight on her back, but a foot pressed down on her left arm, then her right. There were two of them, and they spoke in Chinese, short bursts that were getting angrier. She tried to see who was speaking, and a fist slammed her face into the wet floor. She strained again and was forced down by a forearm across the back of her neck. Carrie opened her eyes wide, her breath escaping. She felt one of them pulling at her legs, tugging off her pants. One pant leg caught on her right ankle, and then was yanked off. She could hear the man a few feet away arguing with the other one about something. Maybe chickening out, or maybe wanting to go first. Carrie kicked free, scrambled to a corner, and then curled into a ball and started shaking, her half-naked body covered in spilled coffee and ash from the floor. She closed her eyes. She thought of the visits at night, always after her mom had drunk herself to sleep. How she would lose herself, escaping to the moment after she would fall from her board, entering the churning froth beneath a powerful wave, inches from the razor-sharp beauty of a reef. In that chaos, there was a beckoning peace. In the churn,
You could hear nothing at all, just a ringing in your ears. If you chose, you could lose yourself in that moment forever. Then the wave would pass, and she would rise again to the surface with a gasp. She reached back to the inside of her left upper arm and peeled away a rectangular band-aid 3 inches long. A searing pain, and the red trickle of blood began to flow. The closer commando grabbed Carrie, pulled her out of the corner, and roughly dragged her upright. She didn't fight him. Her arms hung limply by her sides, and the band-aid dropped to the ground. He wrapped his right hand around her throat, his thumb just under her jaw. He was strong enough to lift her entire body up so that her toes barely touched the ground. Growling, he pulled her in close, reached down with his free left hand, and undid the clasp of his belt. He began to unzip his pants, but then he looked into her eyes and froze. The stillness and tranquility of her eyes drew him in, confused him just for a moment. He didn't even notice the flash in her right hand. The blade itself was short, only 1.5 inches, and just a bit wider than a sheet of paper. Made of ceramic, the box cutter blade she'd taken from her fiancé's toolbox was sharper than a razor and would never rust, not even when hidden in her pain. He did not even feel the first slash arcing upward. So fine was the blade's edge that his body had difficulty registering the damage being done. Even before his opened carotid artery began to spray out, she had slashed downward, arcing across his stomach at an angle just above his belly button. He was pulling his left hand back to punch at her, his pants now falling to the floor, when he noticed his intestines were spilling out. As he fell, grabbing at his stomach, Carrie charged at the other soldier. He struggled with his concealed holster while trying to wipe away the blood from his partner that had sprayed into his eyes. He'd just barely drawn his pistol when she slashed across his wrist, the gun clattered to the floor, and she sliced at the other hand. He countered with a karate chop, but weak, as if he'd already given up. The box cutter blade met his hand in the air and sliced off his left pinky and